Good health is a crown worn by the healthy that only the ill can see. Your health really is your wealth. Join us for the next hour as we explore disease and attaining and maintaining good health. This is Dis-Chem Medical Monday, brought to you by Dis-Chem. Better health starts here.
Good morning. It's Monday, the 2nd of September. It's just gone 8 minutes past 10. My name is Nicholas Ingle, and you're listening to the Dis-Chem Medical Monday show here on 101.9 High FM. We have two guests joining us today. Firstly, and not so, I hope I don't mispronounce your name. It seems to be a really good habit of mine. Bonso Pelani, award-winning health journalist and non-executive director at the Center for Environmental Rights. And we are also going to be joined by Dr. Faziza Patel, clinical scientist renowned for her work in pediatric HIV treatment, optimization, TB, and COVID vaccine research and material health. Let us have your questions or comments on our WhatsApp line, 061-895-1019.
This is Medical Monday, brought to you with the compliments of Dis-Chem. Better health starts here.
You're listening to the Dis-Chem Medical Monday here on 101.9 High FM. I'm your host, Nicholas Ingle, and I'm joined by Bonso Pelani. She is an award-winning health journalist, non-executive director at the Center for Environmental Rights. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
And I hope I didn't butcher your name. It seems to be a very good habit of mine.
No, you did quite well.
Thank you.
You did quite well.
One of my gifts of being dyslexic, so the letters tend to jump around when I'm reading them. So thank you so much for your time for coming on air today. And I wanted to start off our conversation just about the stigma around HIV, and then also go into where HIV is viewed in our society at the moment. I'm 53 years old, and I remember very well sort of the 1980s when HIV started to come into the public awareness, and we were really sort of raised in fear of, you know, if you're not practicing safe relations with your partner, you're at risk of dying, and it's a slow and terrible death. And I think sort of society has almost forgotten that as the younger generations have come along. What's your sort of your view on where we are, and how does society view HIV/AIDS at the moment?
So the era that you're talking about, Nicholas, is when I was quite young. I'm 34 years of age, so I was quite young at the height of the HIV epidemic in South Africa.
Right.
And I really did not experience it firsthand, but I did see what it did in my community. My mom was a very proud and active. She was very proud AIDS activist and helped a lot of people within our community who were experiencing the stigma of HIV because they were HIV infected, the disowning of their family members, and just being really stigmatized and put aside within society.
Yes.
So I experienced that, and I saw in my own personal community my parents being very much against that. However, you know, in my day job, I used to be a journalist and now work at the Soul City Institute for Social Justice, which we know is almost synonymous with the HIV response in South Africa because of the edutainment work that Soul City did to really combat the stigma that people who were living with HIV felt and experienced, and as well as work towards really educating society about what exactly is HIV. And we saw that really happen in the mid to late 90s, as well as the early 2000s, where there was a lot of information about HIV prevention, how to treat people with HIV. And there was a lot of destigmatization that was being prioritized by the government, by non-governmental organizations, and even the private sector. And what I think, even though we have come up or we have survived the epidemic of the late 90s and early 2000s, we are still the largest population of people living with HIV in the world. And this is a good thing that we actually know where we stand, because in many countries, our statistics on HIV, particularly countries that are considered the global south, statistics on HIV and demographics are not kept as intensely and as meticulously as South Africa's. So there's been an investment in trying to understand the epidemic, to understand the HIV situational analysis, for lack of a better phrase. And I think that bodes well for South Africa. However, I do think that on a community and on a more individual level, we still face a lot of HIV stigma.
Right. I mean, this is something that requires a lot of energy and a lot of drive and a lot of involvement by many people behind it to keep it in the forefront of our society's mindset, that we should not be stigmatizing people that are suffering from HIV when people are at their most vulnerable, when families are at their most vulnerable. And then we are seeing societies turning their back on people and on the families as well. How much effort and energy is required to keep this in the forefront of society's mind?
The energy, and I believe it's there. You know, when you think of the Department of National Health, there's still a lot of investment into HIV prevention. There's a lot of research that has been done across South Africa, even across the continent, on new HIV drugs that are better and have less side effects than others. And so we've seen that there's a lot of energy, and we're also seeing a lot of investment, because it takes a lot of money to do the kind of research to improve HIV drugs over time and all of that. However, and this is a biased opinion from somebody who works within communications and advocacy, however, I do think that there's a lag in the investment towards the education and the awareness within society, that we did the heavy lifting in the early 2000s, and we have kind of forgotten about it. And I think it's also indicative when we look at the statistics of HIV among young people in South Africa, especially young women, we see the impact of that.
Sorry, we just had a little bit of noise on the line there.
No problem. Yeah. I think, yes, I was saying that, you know, we're lagging in the educational programming. We're lagging in the awareness building, in the social behavioral change and communication efforts that we saw in the early 2000s. We're not doing that anymore. And we need to see a reinvestment in this, because we call ourselves the Soul City generation, the generation that grew up on Soul City and Soul Buddies. And we're seeing that the young people who were my age during the epidemic don't have the same programming that teaches them how to prevent HIV, how to engage in healthy sexual seeking behavior and relationships, because that programming is not as funded as it used to be. So we need to see this holistic energy, not just on the medicine, not just on the drugs, but also in the social investment into people's psyches and psychology around understanding HIV.
Okay. What is the reason, do you feel, for the drop-off in the funding, the drop-off in support? Why have we stopped doing the heavy lifting?
Oh, that is a very good question and a difficult one at the same time.
That's my job.
The question is quite multi-pronged.
Mm, yes.
When we think about, we have other disease burdens, right? And we see other investments. But also it's a geopolitical and sociopolitical decision where South Africa is not as developing or as poor and struggling as it used to be in the late 90s, at the dawn of democracy, and in the early 2000s. So a lot of international funding organizations see South Africa as a developing or high economy developing country.
Right.
And so there's not as much financial investment into this kind of work here. But also our disease burden has diversified. We're seeing other diseases prop up within society where money has gone as an investment towards it. And we're seeing, again, this biomedical investment into HIV research, which is, do not get me wrong, is incredibly vital, and it
yes.
should continue to happen. However, it shouldn't happen at the cost of the social behavioral work that needs to be done in societies where we are trying to change the minds and the norms and the social, like the ways people socially categorize disease and particularly HIV.
Okay, fantastic. I'm going to, I have another question to follow up from you on that, but first we're going to go to an ad break. Dis-Chem Wellness Clinics for Adults offer convenient and professional care to help you manage health risks. Whether you're having your regular wellness checked, such as blood pressure or cholesterol, Dis-Chem Wellness Clinics offer you a broad range of health screening services, including female health screening with pap smears, family planning, and pregnancy screening. Fast, affordable, and with care. Find your nearest Dis-Chem Wellness Clinic inside Dis-Chem Pharmacies. Better health starts here.
This is Medical Monday, brought to you with the compliments of Dis-Chem. Better health starts here.
It's just gone 22 minutes past 10, Monday the 2nd of September. You're listening to the Dis-Chem Medical Monday show. My name is Nicholas Ingle, and you're joining us on 101.9 High FM. I'm joined by two guests, Poncho Pilani, who is an award-winning health journalist and non-executive director at the Center for Environmental Rights. We've just been chatting about HIV and education around HIV, and sort of the phrase that was used was we stopped doing the heavy lifting that we did in the late 90s, 2000s, and just about reinvigorating education around HIV, because the disease hasn't changed, and if our attitudes are changing towards it, it's putting us at greater risk. And we're also now joined by Dr. Fahiza Patel, clinical scientist, renowned for her work in pediatric HIV treatment optimization, TB and COVID vaccine research, and maternal health. Doctor, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Nicholas. It's a pleasure and a very important topic to be discussed. Thank you.
Absolutely. What I would like to touch on is just in terms of where are we seeing, and this is open to both of you ladies, where are we seeing the attitude in society towards HIV going? And from two aspects. One, in terms of people protecting themselves and their partners, but two, how society is viewing those with HIV. So, Doc, would you like to start first?
Yes, thank you. So my work is very much in the maternal and pediatric space.
Right.
And since women are the most affected by HIV, this is probably the most important space for us to have this discussion. Women are also always considered to be the lesser sex, and their voices often subdued by those of men. And having said that, it's actually men who speak less of this particular disease than it is in women. And what we are seeing is that women are more open to having these discussions. They are more open to having the HIV tests. And with the push for having PrEP options available, it is women pre-pregnancy who are often very keen to get involved in having those options available to them, sometimes with discussion with their partners, and sometimes not. And those do bring up other challenges, including gender-based violence, for example. But in our setting, we're seeing that women are able to have these discussions. In the pediatric population, is a completely different population from adult males,
yes.
for example, where adolescents are often children that have been have contacted HIV from a very young age by perinatal transmission, and that stigma is very different from the stigma of an adult male or female who has contacted HIV through sex.
Right.
And that's a very difficult space to navigate, because disclosure by those particular individuals to their friends, their families, their school, their teachers, is a much more different experience than it is for an adult male or an adult female who has contacted HIV through sexual intercourse.
Right.
Different tools that need to be used depending on the space you're in.
How are we seeing society's attitude or approach to children who are HIV positive?
In our experience, it's been positive. We've got a large number of patients who have had disclosure done to their close family members, who are very supportive of the treatment that they take, as well as the allied care that they would potentially need. So extra schooling, occupational therapy, physiotherapy, speech therapy, etc. and a lot of them have conferred this information to their schools, which is very important.
Yes.
Because it does require them to come to clinics really regularly for their checkups and their medication. For children, it's also very important to have regular visits because their weight changes and the drug doses change according to their weight.
Right.
So very different from an adult who gets a standard dose. And that has to be in some way discussed with the school so that they're aware that that child is required to have quite regular visits at the clinic, especially if there are more issues than just the ART that needs to be prescribed, usually every 3 months.
Right. You know, we were chatting earlier and I was saying I'm 53. I grew up in the 1980s. And when HIV came into public awareness, it wasn't really seen as a child disease or a childhood disease, because it was primarily for adults. Perhaps a child contracted HIV through a blood transfusion with tainted blood. And with things changing now, how big a concern is it from the schools in terms, you know, if boys will roughhouse and play, you know, maybe bump into one another, scrape knees, bleeding, these type of things?
Yeah, so that's very important for prevention of transmission and for discrimination.
Yes.
That does occur. And it is important for us to be able to teach our children who are HIV positive exactly what needs to be done. But it is also very important for us to be able to give this information to the educators and the staff that are taking care of these children at school events, and in order to make sure that there isn't a fear of attending to a patient who potentially does have HIV. The standards should be used, so wearing gloves is very important, whether that's someone who's got HIV or not, because you cannot tell what other infectious diseases a patient may have.
Yes.
And so those very basic skills of wearing gloves, putting pressure on wounds, etc., is what should be done for anyone, whether they're HIV positive or HIV negative.
Right.
It is important for all of us to be able to explain that in the least discriminatory way to all of the staff that would be looking after a patient such as that.
Right. I was chatting earlier with Poncho about education and where we possibly are lacking education. Where would you, and this is a question to both of you ladies, where would you like to see education going in terms of creating awareness, both for those with HIV and those who are in society dealing with them? Poncho, maybe we could start with you on this.
Absolutely. I work with young people. At Soul City, we work with young people as young as 8 years old in schools where we have Soul Buddies clubs and other kind of clubs where young people are taught about HIV prevention at that young age. And I think there has been incredible investment into the education at that age, as well as what Dr. Patel is talking about around disclosure,
yes,
how to manage disclosure as a young as a child who was born of who was born with HIV as something that is part of their lives and how to manage that and ensure there's no stigma. However, I do think, you know, when we're looking at the statistics, when we're looking at the Human Sciences Research Council's latest HIV prevalence study that they do every 5 years, we're seeing that there's a problem around adolescents and young people. And these are the ages between around 14 and 24,
right,
where condom use is quite low. And what is termed risky sexual behavior is quite high. So I feel that, you know, and some research concurs with this, that there needs to be investment into that age group, because that's also where, particularly for young adolescent girls, where we're seeing a lot of new HIV infections come from. And so we need to really invest in that, those teen years, those early teen years and pre-adult years into the early 20s around HIV education, HIV prevention, and really frame a healthy sexual behavior as not just a preventative, as not just a preventative health behavior, right, but as something that can also, you know, preserve the future of your life and your career prospects and your life all in general. While all to say, we can't also stigmatize HIV. We've seen with the drugs and the ARV treatments that are available that people living with HIV live long, healthy lives.
Yes.
However, we still want to really promote prevention, particularly around adolescent young girls.
Right. And I think also perhaps then a question for the doctor. Are we now seeing a more lax attitude towards protection and prevention of HIV because of the awareness of antiretrovirals, the treatment that people can live long lives with it, where sort of, you know, 30 years ago it was almost a guaranteed within a few years you were going to pass away?
I don't think there's a lax attitude towards it. But I do think that there's still a long way to go. We currently have condom use as a long-standing way of protecting against HIV and,
yes,
and other STDs. But more recently, we've got PrEP as options, and PrEP as an oral tablet, and hopefully in the very near future, a long-standing access to injectable PrEP, which is a great way to prevent HIV in a population that is potentially at high risk. Mm-hmm. And there are a number of those in our country. There is also the idea of very mobile populations, which South Africa does have, and maintaining that access, so not just keeping them to urban settings, for example,
right,
is very important. And I know that our government has been making some strides in the uptake of PrEP countrywide, especially with the oral tablets and the dapivirine ring, which is the next option, and then the lenacapavir injectables and other injectables like CAB, which have recently been promoted at the IAS conference in Munich. So a large variety of options, because it's very important to take a patient's circumstances into,
yes,
consideration. And not everybody is able to take a daily tablet. An injectable every few months is potentially a better option for someone. And it is great that we're currently in a space where we do have options. A few years ago, we were very limited in those options.
Right.
But it does come with its challenges, because there are women who potentially would not want to discuss these things with the partner that they,
yeah,
or partners that they currently have. And that's a challenge of its own.
I think to touch on that point, if we could just sort of, if you could give us a rough breakdown or just an understanding on what the preventative measures such as PrEP that are available, what are they in layman's,
okay,
terms? And then also because... go ahead, please.
So currently, the standard option for PrEP is a Truvada tablet, which is essentially two ARVs in a single tablet. which is to be taken on a daily basis around the same time. Still much better than having to take ARVs, which are previously were multiple tablets at multiple time points. So that's been the first option that we've had. The second option that we've done quite a large number of studies on is called the dapivirine ring. And the dapivirine ring is actually a ring that's inserted into the vagina of a female patient, and is not usually able to be felt by the partner, and is quite discreet. So something that is not obvious to anyone, and she can have inserted without the awareness of anyone around her. More recently, there have been injectables, which we have been doing a large number of studies on. Some of them we've been doing studies as treatment, and some of them have been as prevention. So the cabotegravir injections are one of them that are also to be given as a preventative treatment. It is given as a treatment for ARVs along with another drug called rilpivirine. But these are nice injectables that are very similar to your contraceptive injections and have similar durations of action. So they can be administered at the same time, for example, which is very useful for the ability of a patient to be able to go to a clinic at one stage for multiple treatments that prevent her from falling pregnant as well as prevent her from getting HIV.
Right.
And that's very important because a lot of our patients one must never assume that they are not working patients or that they are not patients who have active social lives, for example, that do not have time to sit in clinics for long periods of time or have multiple clinic visits.
Okay. And I think it's so vital that there is the availability of, I suppose if you could call it almost stealth or private use treatment, where it's keeping that away from the partner, because I think women in South Africa are always at greater risk because sometimes it's not really an option whether they are going to be sleeping with their partners or not. And you know they need that ability to protect themselves. So what I would like to ask next, what are we seeing in terms of the stigmatism against adult HIV patients? Bont, would you like to answer this one? We could start with you.
Sure, no problem. We, especially with adults, what we're seeing is, and this is just the evidence we're seeing on the ground in the various programs we run across the country at Soul City, is that this idea, because the HIV is primarily, particularly transferred through sexual intercourse.
Yes.
There is a stigmatization of people's sexuality and what they're doing. And they're often seen as being more reckless than other people who might not be living with the virus. And we're seeing that a lot of stigmatization comes from the sexualization of people living with HIV and the circumstances that they live in, and often them being characterized as promiscuous or other kind of very stigmatizing language around that. And for me, particularly with the work that we do at Soul City, what has been primarily our focus is also the contextualization of the fact that a lot of the young adult population with HIV, a significant amount of them were people who were born with HIV, right?
Right.
And so this stigmatization is wrong regardless, but it's also factually incorrect in many instances. And these are some of the things that we work towards trying to prevent through social behavioral change, communication, through various programs we run in and out of school.
Right.
To really shape or put out the message that HIV is not just this disease that people who sin or people who are considered to be promiscuous in any way get.
Right.
That it is an illness just like any other illness.
And I'd like to continue on this point straight after these ad breaks.
This is Medical Monday, brought to you with the compliments of Dis-Chem. Better health starts here.
It's just gone 10:42 and you are listening to 101.9 High FM. It's the Dis-Chem Medical Monday. I'm Nicholas Ingle and I'm joined by two guests, Pontso Pilani, award-winning health journalist and non-executive director at the Center for Environmental Rights, and Dr. Faiza Patel, clinical scientist renowned for her work in pediatric HIV treatment optimization, TB, and COVID vaccine research and maternal health. We've been chatting all things HIV, from treatment to stigmatization. And I wanted to just go back and touch on sort of societal stigma of those living with HIV, particularly adults. Doctor, could you share your thoughts on this with us, please?
Yes, thanks, Nicholas. I think for us, one of the most important things is adjusting the way people use language and the names that are used for people who live with HIV. So we've moved significantly away from calling people HIV infected or people with HIV positive people, and using words like people living with HIV or woman living with HIV, for example.
Right.
And these are much less discriminatory words, much less labeling words, and seem to be better received by those that are affected by this particular disease. So that's one of the most important things we're doing as scientists and as doctors, to be able to assist with less stigmatization of people living with what is currently a chronic disease that is,
yes,
that is able to be controlled with minimal intervention, actually, compared to what we used to do before. One of the most important things for me, though, is we often talk about community perceptions of people who are living with HIV. But one of the most important things for me is how they perceive themselves. And this is very important because there are large amounts of women and children who have been living with HIV of no fault of their own, who often have blame and guilt issues. And issues that then result in quite a poor self-image. And when you have a poor self-image and don't have enough confidence in yourself, it is very difficult for you to be able to tell someone else that you've got HIV, to be able to tell someone else that you have to take ARVs. And there are things that occur in the normal scope of life that then are difficult to do because you can't go out with your friends at night because then you're going to miss your tablets. And these sorts of very small things in the general scope of life, but for a patient like this, are quite difficult to do if they don't have a great self-image. And for me, that's quite important. And a lot of work that we do with disclosure of patients does include that, especially the adolescents. They're going through adolescence with its own challenges. And this is an additional, quite large aspect of something they need to deal with. And it's definitely not an easy thing for them to do.
Right. We've spoken briefly about education of society, education of the public. What is being done to educate the patients about sort of their reality, but not developing a strong negative self-image? You know, if you have a bad self-image, you're going to be less likely to want to protect yourself, to put yourself into safe places, to surround yourself with people that can support you and grow you. You either isolate or you choose to go down the wrong path in terms of who you are socializing with. What is being done to educate the patients?
On our side, and part of the National Department of Health's plan for doing disclosure, which is a very important thing, is actually a gentle introduction of the concepts of HIV.
Right.
And it's done usually over a period of time with a patient, depending on the specific family dynamics. Often there's a mom, often there isn't a mom who has passed away, and it's a caregiver, an aunt or a granny, for example. And those are slightly more challenging because the patient then has to understand why it is potentially that the mom is not in their space and able to do this. And it's a very gentle introduction to what a virus is, how your virus is spread, very similar to the information that's given at school, so complementary of all of that. And as over a period of about 2 years, we try to do a general introduction where then it gets to the final discussion on saying the big words.
Right.
Saying the HIV, saying you know, by then they're a little bit older and understand how that virus is transmitted and how it's prevented and how they potentially have gotten HIV from their mother during pregnancy or breastfeeding. And it's a gentle introduction. To be able to do this in a space with the family is very important. So it's not something that's done with the child alone. It's something that has to be reinforced at home by the family. So the family have to be saying the same sort of things that they are being told at the clinic in
right.
order for all of this information to be reinforced. Because contradictory information is just going to confuse them. And so it's very important that the staff that are doing the disclosure have a good relationship with the family and are timing this according to the family's current social space. If there are other challenges that are going on, for example, school challenges or bullying at school or something else, those takes a little bit more priority and the disclosure becomes a gentler process. So it's very much geared towards doing it on an individual basis, taking the family and the child into consideration. So there's no one size fits all.
Right.
And I know she'll be able to tell you a good amount about the groups that we have for adolescents, which is also very important.
Fantastic. And I'd like to touch on that as soon as we are back from this ad break.
This is Medical Monday, brought to you with the compliments of Dis-Chem. Better health starts here.
You're listening to the Dis-Chem Medical Monday. My name is Nicholas Ingle, and you're on 101.9 High FM. We're wrapping up with our guests, Poncho Palani, and with Dr. Fahiza Patel. We're chatting all things HIV. We're focusing now on the training or the education that's being done for patients. Also, would you share with us what you guys are doing?
So, Buddies clubs in about 700 schools across the country.
Wow.
In all 9 provinces. And before funding was a problem, we used to run even 15,000 of these clubs across schools. And this teaches young people, children, school-going children between the ages of 8 and 14 on how, you know, to treat people living with HIV, how to prevent it, what is HIV, and what is even disclosure that they can have friends with HIV and how that HIV could potentially be transmitted to their peers. We
right.
also run what is called we used to run them in school, but we run them out of school now, called RISE clubs. These are particularly for young women. Because at Soul City, using the research that is available in South Africa, we saw that young women are more at risk of
yes.
HIV infection than their peers. And we run these clubs to help them self-actualize, but also so that they make better sexual and reproductive health decisions and are informed also around the preventions, as Dr. Patel mentioned, around PrEP and other ways, and how to negotiate condom use. What does it mean to have autonomy in a relationship to ensure condom use and those kind of things? But we also have a long history of adherence clubs. So these adherence clubs are often clubs made out of people living with HIV, and they support each other, and it's a support group for them to just talk about their struggles, their wins, their triumphs, and everything that has to do, and they evolve. In some cases in the past, we've had adherence clubs become burial societies, become sure. community organizations that really impact on the communities and go beyond just talking about HIV.
Wow, that's absolutely incredible. And as I'm an alcoholic, I've been sober for 18 years, and I know in my struggle with sobriety, the support groups, Alcoholics Anonymous, has been one of my strongest pillars. So that's absolutely wonderful to hear. What I would like to ask both of you just as we wrap up, what can we as society do to support not only the patients but the families? What are the few small things that we could do? So, Doc, I don't know if thank you. Sorry.
No, first and foremost, I think destigmatizing and being stigma-free, right? The messages of the early 2000s are still relevant when it comes to stigma, that my friend with HIV is still my friend, my family member with HIV is still my friend. But also, I think what we can do as a whole, as society, is to really practice preventative health-seeking behavior.
Right.
Go for regular HIV testing. Use condoms while we engage in sexual behavior, sexual intercourse, and also protect ourselves in different ways. But more than anything, we need to realize and we need to treat society and people living with HIV in particular without the stigma that used to exist in the past.
Thank you so much. And Doctor, from you, just very quickly.
I think the most important thing is just to keep talking about it, keeping right. it out there and keeping it as positive as it is at this point in time is great. And talking about the future research and the new options and ways in which we're making lives of people living with HIV better. This is important to constantly have in the forefront.
Fantastic. Thank you, Doc. So that's stay educated, get educated, and share that knowledge with others and keep it in the forefront of people's minds. Puntjo Pilani and Dr. Faiza Patel, thank you so much for joining me. You've been listening to the Dis-Chem Medical Monday here on 101.9 Chai FM. My name is Nicholas Ingle.